On the last episode of the Video Archives podcast, Roger and Quentin put on a little lipstick.
There's an approach to the violence that's occurring that somehow makes it watchable as if it's mass entertainment.
Got in the ring with the one and only.
They don't want to see that stupid play. They wanted to laugh, and I gave them a reason to laugh.
And traveled back to 1978 through the lens of Slithus.
This movie is almost serves as a kind of document of the city at that time.
And now we bring you the after show, your backstage pass to exclusive content, answers to your burning questions, and even more film discussion. I'm your muck monster, Gala Avery, or Spawn of the Avery, depending on who you ask. You may not know it, but I am always listening. I was at a local boba cafe and overheard a discussion of a group of high schoolers all about movies. I couldn't help but bring the question to Video Archives to hear what Roger and Quentin thought about it.
You know, before you guys begin, I actually have a question for you guys. Mm-hmm. Because, okay, so when I listen to the podcast, I try to do things, like when the edits, I try to do things that are like normal people things that normal people would do when they listen to podcasts.
So you play act.
Yeah, I pretend I'm a normal person. I do my laundry.
I was going to say dishes.
I do my laundry. I do dishes. I hula hoop. But one of the things I do, I like to go to this boba cafe near me. Mm-hmm. And I'm listening to the podcast. And all of a sudden, I hear these like high schoolers behind me. And they start saying, well, is Parasite a classic movie? And I'm like, Parasite? Is that a classic movie? And they start having this big discussion on what is a classic movie. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to figure out what's a classic movie. So I wanted to ask you guys, what do you guys consider a classic movie to be?
Yeah, because if you're born in like 95 or something, or even later, like a classic movie can be, you know,
want this?
Is it before you're born?
Well, I started having this debate with people about like how long does it take to become a classic movie?
Actually, I think in the old days, it was like 20 or 30 years. I think like 20 doesn't seem that long. I think 30 years, actually.
Yeah, because 20 was like what I started saying. And then people are saying, no, like 10, 15. I'm saying that's not long enough.
Well, what about the whole thing of like an instant classic? This movie
that's not a real thing.
That's not a real thing.
That's a marketing thing.
Okay, that's what because I was saying 20 years and everyone was saying, well, what about cult classics? What about instant classics? And I was saying, it's a different thing.
By virtue of it being a cult classic, it's not a classic.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was saying. Okay, I'm right. That's all I got to know is that I'm right. That's all I got to know.
That means it's a weird little movie that a lot of weird people thought was like special.
Yeah, but it's not a classic.
Yeah, okay. But cult classics usually are 10 years old.
Yeah.
10 to 20 years old.
And then just also, because people were also asking me, well, can a classic movie stop becoming a classic movie? Like, if you have a movie that's a classic movie, can it later not be a classic movie?
No, its fortunes can rise and fall. Yeah. All right. You know, it will always be an old movie. All right. And if you want to call all old movies classics, you can. You don't put it in the old movie section of the videos. Now, not all old films are classics, but certain films will have they'll have their day. They'll go through a period where they're not thought of as highly.
Yeah.
And maybe that comes around. You know, there was a time in the 70s that High Noon was not thought of as
when I was first introduced to the High Noon as a film, as a boy, it was like, it's just like kind of this garbage movie.
Well,
it's like a programmer.
Well, especially, it's like one of the only Westerns to actually win Oscars. All right. You know, but especially there was this whole thing about a High Noon in the 70s because Howard Hawks was against it. And he was like, the only reason I made Rio Bravo was put a lie to, because I detested High Noon so much that I put a lie to it. And a lot of people kind of jumped on that bandwagon. Mm. All right. Yeah. And then it started turning back around because actually the film is actually an editing tour de force. It's a movie completely saved by editing. And so anybody who appreciates good editing is going to be taken over by
like
by
director
High
Peter
Noon.
Hyams, who edits his own films and did almost a remake of High Noon with Outland.
I don't think he edits his own films. That. I think he's in the room.
He's in the guild and he's an editor. He's edited. But
like he doesn't take credit for it.
Okay.
And he is not above taking credit. No, he's hands-on, all right?
I mean of him more as somebody, he can do it all, yes. It looks like he can do it all. Mm-hmm. And it does.
No, Joe Dante was pushing a reappraisal of High Noon on editing basis alone.
Oh.
But, you know, but that's a good example.
And Joe Dante would know. There's another guy who's like a master editor. Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah.
The reason why lipstick is so effective is because the film highlights the realism in our world. Unfortunately, justice isn't always served to victims. Quentin highlights the frustrations that we all felt while watching the outcome of the courtroom sequence.
I forgot about this scene and just you talk, you waxing poetically about the courtroom scene reminded me my other favorite, along with her screaming, you're killing me. All right. My other favorite Mariel Hemingway moment in the film is after the verdict happens and then the rapist is like found not guilty. Both two sisters are pounced on by the press in this feeding frenzy that finally, like, Anne Bancroft gets them behind a door. And then Mariel Hemingway, like, fuck! It's so realistic.
Yeah.
It was like, what the fuck was that?
Yeah.
It's not even talking about the verdict.
with a very quick, awkward fade to black afterwards.
Yeah. It's just like, fuck, what the hell was that?
Yeah.
And like, you feel her frustration. You're big time.
For Chris Sarandon fans out there, you'll all know about his surprise performance in Dog Day Afternoon, which, by the way, is an amazing heist film. You guys should all go watch it. Heist Gone Wrong is one of my favorite subgenres. Quentin and Roger discuss the methodology behind Sarandon taking the role in Lipstick immediately after Dog Day Afternoon. And as an added bonus, I weigh in on some of my favorite Chris Sarandon performances, including 1977 Sentinel.
And it was actually kind of very interesting because he had just done Dog Day Afternoon earlier, where he was playing the Al Pacino's love interest partner who wants to undergo a sex change operation.
Yeah, transsexual.
So everyone thought that's who he was.
Yeah, he's so good at it.
Yeah, he was so good at it.
They must have really found a
real... they found some pre-op drag queen or something like that. And
no. I am an actor.
Yeah, and well, apparently he accepted the part of the rapist in Lipstick simply just to prove
that.
He had to counteract his performance in Dog Day Afternoon.
Quentin, I mean, you mentioned Dog Day Afternoon, and he goes to Lipstick, and then after Lipstick, he does The Sentinel, which I don't know if either of you guys have seen it, but The Sentinel is wonderful, and he follows up his performance as a rapist with the performance of him being the best boyfriend possible. And subverting all tropes.
Having completely counteracted the seesaw.
The best boyfriend possible in the worst devil occult movie possible.
I disagree, but maybe that's a conversation for another time.
Well, that's a conversation for a different time.
Because I love that movie.
However, I will say this. I had heard that the book was really good, like way after the fact. Mm-hmm. And so I tracked down a copy of the Sentinel book and started reading it. The book is so bad, I realized actually Michael Winner did a better job in the movie than I gave him credit. Now,
he fixed the book.
I don't think that's ever been said. Michael Winner did a better job than previously thought possible.
That's a crazy-ass film, though, by the way, The Sentinel, with all the...
freaks that show up at the
end. I didn't want to say it, but yeah. Just like
the guy with the balls on his chin.
They roll up.
I always remember the guy with the
testicle
balls on
face.
His chin.
Yeah,
that's the craziest
testicle
one.
Face. If there is a hell, it's got a guy with balls on his face.
Just to clear things up, my reference to calling him the best boyfriend possible in Sentinel is me trying to avoid spoilers for all of you who haven't had the chance to watch this awesome movie. So once you've seen it, let's have a chat about it. I hope you guys agree with me that it's a great movie, because I have a feeling that Quentin and I will go toe-to-toe on it. Next up, something that all of us are still thinking about, the music in Lipstick. I can't listen to the music without feeling physically ill from watching the intense scene that played alongside of it. Roger and Quentin talk about the effective score by Michel Polnareff and how the music marries source and score.
As far as best soundtrack, best composition, best composer, Michel Polnareff.
Okay.
Probably should also be given.
I don't know if the word best. All right. Well, is applicable.
Most effective.
Most nauseating.
Most disturbing. Yeah. Most rapey music. It should be given. But it should also.
I might throw irritating in there.
Yeah, it should also be given to David Foster, who at that time was
It smacks of that electronic noise that Quincy Jones tried to pass off. All right, as a score in like the Anderson tape.
Yeah, that's for sure.
When he's playing the rape music, his rape music, that's
yeah
sourced
his source music.
Yeah, in the film, that composer adds a movie composition on top
yeah.
of it.
It becomes, it goes from source to score.
Yeah. It just marries it because the source is still going on.
Yeah.
But then there's a little thriller movie music thrown on there that actually seems part of his composition.
Yeah.
It just, there's a little editorializing going on, and you know he's going to rape her as soon as she hangs up the phone.
Yeah.
That's a neat moment, the way it brings a score into the source, but they're almost indistinguishable. The only thing that you can tell that his score is, it's a little better. It's a little better than his source music.
Yeah.
When watching Lipstick, Roger couldn't help but think of Video Archives employee Scott McGill. Roger recounts a personal story in connection to one of his best friends and the insane music in this movie.
I had very strange feelings watching him in this mm-hmm. because he looked and even dressed exactly like our old friend, our deceased friend, Scott McGill.
Mm-hmm.
And, Chris Sarandon kind of looked yeah. like Scott. And Scott was a composer.
I'll go with the dressing part, but I don't know if he looks like
well,
him.
Well, he kind of had that, you know, the little in this movie, okay. he looked like him to me. It was recalling him to me. I couldn't look at him and not think about him.
Mm-hmm.
Not mostly because Scott used to do that. He would write some piece of music, some mm-hmm.
piano concerto.
Some piano concerto, because he was brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And he would write it, and then he would, like, you know, meet you in, I don't know, a parking lot somewhere or someplace, you know, a schoolyard or somewhere near other mm-hmm. people where anybody, and he would with a boombox and start playing it for you.
Mm-hmm.
Here, let me play you my concerto for rape number two.
Yeah, right.
Put it on and you're there and you're like, this is great, but I don't really want to be listening to it here in the middle of like the parking lot with like the basketball players over there looking at us. Feels weird.
Like when I read my reviews to you.
Well, you don't choose to do that in the middle of, well, maybe you would.
Yeah.
But, and I don't know, it's music is such a personal, at least in the way that Scott's music was. I don't know. So anyhow, it started reminding me of Scott.
Well, look, I buy that
in a kind of weird way, because the guy's a rapist in the movie. Like, and Scott is not I'll be clear. I'm not implying that, but you know, it actually,
he was an odd duck. He's not a rapist, but he was an odd duck. And this guy's an odd duck.
Well, it caused me to go back, you know, Scott, who worked at Video Archives, whose father was at Video Outtakes. I mean, he committed suicide, and he left a document and a musical piece to mm-hmm. me. The musical piece was called Summer of 1987,
mm-hmm.
and it is a 4-hour long musical piece. And I've only listened to like the first side of the first tape, because I just can't bring myself to mm-hmm. listen to the whole thing. And he left me a document called The Initial Understanding, which you know about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was his kind of explanation for why he did it. And I reread it after this movie.
Oh, really?
It actually caused me to go back and reread it, by which I quickly learned his whole concern was, I'm not talented enough. I know that I'm not as talented as I want to be. I wish that I was stupid and thought that I was talented, even though I wasn't. That would have been preferable.
Also,
and he's so dumb, because his movie was, it was better than most of us at that level.
And it was, you know, and
at
also,
that age.
He was also, he questioned his stamina.
Yeah.
To be able to actually make it in the business. He questioned his stamina.
Yeah,
Less his talent, more his stamina.
It's true. It's true. It actually, I wrote down a line that he said, which felt weird appropriate to me. It was, I wish I could write a song. Even if I was a bad songwriter who believed he was a great songwriter, that would be good enough.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I started thinking about like being so into your music. I started thinking about movies like Phantom of the Paradise, which was one of his favorite mm-hmm. films. A lot of his movies were these emotional, very musical, emotionally connected movies. And I started thinking about this guy who's a mess.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is the inside of his head, this music that he's playing. He's trying to share it with people.
Is VHS always better? Well, not in this case. Quentin recounts how a joke in The One and Only landed differently when watching it on the big screen.
And then the way it's presented on television, this was not just a flaky thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So she realizes, oh no, this is actually a legitimate career now.
And she also said, I don't want you mm-hmm. like this fake version of you. And he's being fake.
Yeah.
He's like, well, he's wearing the underwear, even the.
Yeah,
the
well, no, by the way, that joke is a little lost on television, all right? Because in the theater, when she goes like, take all that junk off. And he takes all the clothes off, and he's got just those furry panties. All right, it's not as clear that they're furry panties as it was.
Maybe on the Blu-ray it was.
Yeah, yeah. As it was at the movie theater, because it brought the whole house down when you really saw the fur, and he even strokes it a little bit.
Yeah. and I really like her line at the end. Like, if you got panties under those, it's over.
Yeah. He goes, so like, what are those? And then it stops it. Like, what is it? Hey, I have to feel the part all the way down.
De Niro would.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't move on from the one and only without giving a shout out to my favorite actor in the film. For anyone wondering, yes, I really do love Hervé Villechaize. I'm actually watching Fantasy Island right now because of him. Z-plane! Thanks for all of the smiles in the one and only, Hervé. You are my favorite part of it. Ahem. Now that I've gotten that out of my system, let's turn to Slithus, or Spawn of the Slithus. Roger and Quentin were overjoyed by this movie. So much so that I couldn't help but do a little bit of digging when it came to some of the actors in this movie. I was hoping to come up with some information on Roger's favorite, Bunky, but sadly, I came up short. It seems that he was either a Venice local or one of Stephen Traxler's friends. On Quentin's favorite, Rex, however, I was able to find a little bit of information. It seems that Don Cummins was a North Carolina-based actor appearing in Dinner Theater Productions in Charlotte. He was a regular for J.G. Pat Patterson, a Southern-based producer-director, and acted in some of his films, like 1972's The Body Shop, also known as Axe, and 1976's The Electric Chair. But let's talk about the real stars of the show, the characters of Venice Beach and the spawn of Slithus itself. For Quentin and Roger, the combination of groovy monsters, interesting characters, and iconic cities pushed this movie over the top.
The way Pittsburgh or Baltimore are.
The city is more a character in this movie than like almost any other movie I've ever, even like, I think I was mentioning other movies that have cities as characters like Don't Look Now or, you know, where the city of Venice is, you know, like a character
But New World Pictures uses Venice all the time because it's right outside their lumberyard.
But this was more than just using Venice, but never
like a character the way this is.
This was like, we're going to show you all of Venice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Rhode Island School of Design, at one point, they were like trying to save stuff and they were keeping an archive of porn films. Mm-hmm. And at one point this was challenged, like, why is the Rhode Island School of Design keeping this library of porn films? And it was because they were trying to preserve the interior design and fashion elements that were inside of those films.
Absolutely.
Which were just taking, there's furniture in those movies that, you know, Ero Arneo chairs.
We haven't mentioned that much about the monster yet, but just before we get off this.
Well, that's because this is almost more important than the monster.
Almost.
The character of Venice in this film.
If, you know.
Venice Beach.
Look, I would agree with you. The monster is actually pretty groovy. So the combination of a groovy monster, a really, really groovy monster suit. And then all this Venice iconography is like, it's irresistible.
Yeah.
All the cheapness of the movie adds to it. Except the monster suit itself is not cheap. The monster suit is very well done.
I would say all the, everybody is bringing everything to this. I mean, this is one of those movies that, when you described it to me, it was like, oh, this is like a kind of a homegrown film. And it was a bunch of, you know, Hollywood tech people who got together and made this movie. So it's like, for lack of a better way of putting it, a lot of, you know, some below the line folks got together and used their amazing talent to make something for basically nothing. Mm-hmm. And the movie scores with me on many, many levels.
As a quick aside, Slithus captures the feeling of Venice Beach extremely well and feels like a time capsule that brings you right back to 1978. But, in my opinion, something should stay in 1978, such as the turtle races. Although it could be argued as cultural heritage, turtle races are a hot debate issue right now. As a friend to the turtles, you won't find me at Brennan's, as I personally think the turtles should be left alone. Slithus may capture the city, architecture, and interior design, but it also captured the fashion of the time.
One outfit in particular caught Quentin's eye.
Before I go into the history, the one other thing must be mentioned is that at some point, the lead character, for a long period of time, he's wearing this outfit, this one-piece outfit that you're watching and you're like, what the fuck is that he's wearing? And you're looking and I go, holy shit, that's the Italian leisure suit outfit that the kid buys in Freaks and Geeks. That's the real version of it. That's what it really looked like.
And he is rocking it like in a way that like I couldn't.
No, he's really rocking it. I mean, the closest thing the guy has to coolness is he can wear the Italian leisure suit and make it stick.
Yeah, the Jufro helps a little.
Yeah, the Jufro helps a lot. And as I read it and as I and I just saw another film recently, Death Promise, and the lead character in that is like this Puerto Rican martial arts guy, and he wears an Italian leisure suit.
Does he pull it off the way Alan Blanchard does?
Not as thoroughly as Alan Blanchard does, but he pulls it off. They all pull it off better than the kid in Freaks and Geeks.
Which wasn't intentional.
Yeah, but it's nice to know that that Italian leisure suit was an actual thing. It wasn't just something yanked out of Judd Apatow's ass.
Okay, guys, let's talk about Jeff. What was up with women of this time period being named Jeff? Jeffrey with a J was the 15th most popular name in the 1970s, for boys. And Jeffrey with a G was the 193rd most popular, for boys. So what's with all these ladies named Jeff in exploitation films? Does anyone out there know the answer? Please tell me. If you want to hear me rant about the other Video Archives Jeff, Jennifer Gann, and Women in Cages, make sure to go back to After Show Episode 1. But for now, let's sing the praises to the good Jeff played by Judy Motulski.
There's something to be said about how in any other actress's hands, a lot of the lines that she was delivered could have been more abrasive. Like, I don't believe you, what you're doing. Why don't you just like focus on your work and everything? But the way she's delivering those lines is always kind of in a loving way. Mm-hmm. Like she's never like, I still actually love you.
Yeah, okay, one of the good lines is when he's talking about seeing these dogs that were ripped apart. He goes, well, it's sort of like this, I told you about that deer that I told you about that deer that I saw. Well, you said you saw a dead deer. You go, no, but it was face was ripped off. It was just like a satanic ritual. She goes, whatever that would look like.
She had a lot of really good lines.
Yeah.
She had a lot of really good lines. Like I was kind of hoping to see Judy Motulski in more.
No.
More than this.
If it had another low budget movie that she was the star or even the fifth lead, I would make a point to put it on. All right. For our next movie.
Yeah. Well, you can also catch Judy Motulski as a passenger in The Big Bus from 1976,
oh, wow.
Which actually kind of would like to see that again.
No, that's one of the ones. I don't know if we're going to get through it, but that's one of the ones I want us to give it a shot.
I would really like to give it a shot because there's one line in that when the room is filling up with soda and he has to go down and like undo something. He comes back up. And he's like, I can't see anything down there. Uh-huh. Yeah. But they're swimming in like Coca-Cola.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like opening his eyes under. Anyhow, she's also in The Waltons.
Oh, cool. Investigator Gala on the case. I dug up some information on Judy Motulski. She married actor Robert Walker and the two opened up a gallery together, which sold functional art made by friends. One of their products was the sterling silver bubbler necklace, which Madonna blew at concerts. Sadly, Robert Walker passed away on December 5th, 2019. Judy Motulski Walker now runs a business called Topps Malibu, which sells party favors. If you want to go check out her products, go to toppsmalibu.com. The care and love that was put into Slithus reminded Roger of another director who uses the city of Los Angeles to his advantage, Don Coscarelli.
From the very first kind of shot of the movie, that sort of what I call or we called the Kenny and Company. So you haven't seen Kenny and Company, but it is from Kenny and Company. Right. Kenny and Company is this movie by Don Coscarelli, who I'm a big fan of. He directed Phantasm, but he did this movie when he was like 18 or 19 called Kinney and
Company. 12-year-old kids.
Yeah. About 12-year-old kids. And it probably takes place about 1978. Kinney is probably around when it was made. And there's this moment.
It could literally be a scene taken from the outtakes of Kinney and Company.
And in fact, this is almost like a movie Don Coscarelli could have made.
Yeah.
In watching it, I was like, there was enough care and love put into these little minor moments that I felt somebody was treasuring it the way Don does.
Okay, we really, really, really like Slithus here at Video Archives. But there was one performance in the movie that stuck out like a sore thumb, the police chief. I may have said on the main episode that I liked his wacky performance, but I tend to like bizarre characters that appear to be in their own movie. But yeah, it was weird and out of place and definitely not up to the level of the other performances in the movie. Roger reveals a theory about a potentially deleted scene, along with a difference in one important moment watching on VHS versus 35mm film.
Yeah, well, you can, except that it's okay. So,
but it does take the piss out of everybody else because I think you see everybody else is actually trying.
Everyone's trying, and he comes in and he's thinking that he's look. He came in and nobody regulated that guy. It was like they called Roger Avery and they said, "Hey, come in and be a wacky cop."
No, but you wouldn't do it like him. So you're ruining your argument by using yourself. All right.
Well, I suspect that there was a scene cut with him. Mm-hmm. I suspect at some point they looked at it in editing and it was like, we got to get rid of this guy. And there is a first scene with him because they mentioned.
Yeah, he's mentioned earlier.
And
yeah.
So, but I suspect Mimi later probably told them, listen, looking at the script, you're going to have to keep this second scene. There's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, he's the police captain. You got to have captain. Yeah.
And so you kind of suffer through those moments, but you're rewarded.
Yeah, so Stephen Traxler needed to adjust him on the day.
Correct. And you're rewarded with these other magnificent moments, like the bunky character, John Hatfield, and frankly, you know, just all these other
the weird doctor guy with the fucked up face. All okay, right.
That was the scene that I thought worked better on VHS.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
when we watched that on 35, you had a beautiful print of it. We're watching the movie. We see it. There's a long shot of that guy, and you can see that his face is messed up. Mm-hmm. And then he comes down, and the camera's kind of panning with them, and they're strategically blocking him mm-hmm. with foreground elements until he steps into his close-up. Mm-hmm. And it's like we see that he's this doctor who's obviously been studying the radioactivity too closely.
Yeah.
He's all mutated and everything, and it's meant to be a shock moment.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
It's similar to that moment in The Brood when the guy lowers the ascot.
Yeah, exactly. And so it still kind of works, but on VHS, it was softer and a little darker. And so he's actually bathed in shadow. And I think the VHS, believe it or not, actually is more true to the original intention.
Yeah, I think you might be right.
Because he comes down and we actually don't see the face. It's bathed in shadow the entire time until he comes into close-up.
I agree with Roger. When I watched on digital, I could immediately tell that the guy's face was messed up from the radiation. I lost the shock and surprise reveal that the director intended. To wrap up our episode, let's listen to another theory. This time, it comes from me. What was up with the photograph of Rex, the neighbor that was borrowing the boat, and the pre-lit candles? Could it be love?
Yeah.
Okay, wait, I have a small, theory about that photo, actually, that plays into the guy that's on borrowing his boat. I don't think he's borrowing his boat. I think that's his gay lover that's come and has been waiting for him there.
Well, that is kind of like
because there's candles burning. There's a picture of him. I think he's like in there.
Is this Avery thing when you have nothing else to say? You yank out the gay subtext.
No,
we read into films. You read into it.
Look, he's just
why else
there?
Would the candles be lit?
Yes.
Why are the candles lit?
That and his gay lover is Tom Selleck from Coma.
That is the evidence.
Or it is the son of the seltzer in the one and only. There you go. Who knows?
The son of seltzer in one and only grows up to be Rex.
Yeah.
Rex is
okay. Rex.
Rex. Is,
look, I.
He's the king.
We've got so much subtext on Rex. He's not gay.
No,
not bi-leaning, all right.
No, but that other guy who's sitting on his boat might be his, like...
I mean, look, Rex could be trisexual. He could be wanting to try anything. Who knows?
Well, no, he doesn't.
Oh,
he,
you mean the... Oh, yeah. Oh,
I'm talking
you
about...
You mean that guy just hanging out on the boat? What the fuck are you doing here, man?
Yeah, what the fuck are you doing here? Oh, I'm just watching TV until you got home. I thought we'd hang out. And he's like, Three's a crowd. You might want to go. Yeah, and then he's like, I don't know what that guy's a frustrated boat owner who wishes he had a boat. He lives in the buildings in the marina here. Who is this guy who comes out and sits on his boat and lights the candles?
Actually, that makes sense.
And that's our show. Thanks so much for tuning into the Video Archives After Show. Have a burning question that you want the answers to? Make sure to write in for a chance to have your question featured on the After Show. Next week, join Quentin and Roger as they discuss three new films. Want to know ahead of time what we're watching? Here's a riddle for all of you loyal fans out there. Try and figure it out. The first movie is based on the private life of a detective. The second movie takes place in a fiery land and features a returning Video Archives leading lady. And the third is a Mexican action film featuring a family under siege. Hell hath no fury like me, Gala Avery, signing out for today. See you next time on the Video Archives After Show.